Until recently, I thought a gerbil was a small rodent, popular as a children's pet. But in the last few weeks, I've discovered the word has taken on a new political significance. Some of you are probably aware of it too. It's become the acronym for a piece of major legislation which Kenneth Baker intends to bring before Parliament during this present session. The Great Education Reform Bill. Gerbil for short. As any of you who have ever kept gerbils will know, though they look harmless enough, they can give you a nasty bite. And once let loose from their cage, they can cause all kinds of havoc in the average living room. That being so, I suspect gerbil may prove to be a peculiarly appropriate abbreviation for Mr. Baker's act. For it too has longer teeth than you might think from casual observation. And the havoc which it's likely to cause to our education system is far greater than I think most people at present imagine. Fortunately, I have a gerbil of my own to offer you this morning. I'd like to commend it to you. I have to warn you, you may find it just as controversial as Mr. Baker's act, if not more so. For my gerbil is God's education reform bill. And you'll find it in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Interestingly, on a superficial level at any rate, it has two apparent similarities to the legislation at present before our Parliament. I say apparent similarities because I think when we examine it a little closer, we'll discern that Moses and the baker are really not on the same wavelength where education is concerned. But at least superficially, there are two similarities. And those two similarities will serve as the structure around which I'd like to build our study of Deuteronomy 6 this morning. First of all, Moses wanted a national curriculum. Secondly, Moses emphasized parental involvement. Let's look at those two things. First, a national curriculum. These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you're crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God. Now, as we saw last week, those of us who were here, when God brought the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, he didn't leave them to evolve their own constitutional law. On the contrary, they were to be a nation under God, subject to his sovereign rule. And accordingly, he gave them the legal framework they needed by an act of divine revelation. My commands, my decrees, my laws. That's what Moses calls them here in verse 1. Keep them, said God, and you will prosper in the promised land on the other side of the River Jordan. Flout them, and you will forfeit both your prosperity and your land. Those were the simple terms of the agreement God made with Israel, the covenant, as he called it. And as Moses, looked around at the gathered nation of Israel, mustered on the east bank of Jordan, ready to cross the river and invade the promised land and take possession of it, it was not difficult for him to see how precarious Israel's future was as a result of the way it hinged on the faithful fulfillment of those covenant obligations. See, Moses knew the Israelites all too well. He'd been with them for 40 years. He knew it had been one thing to get the Israelites out of Egypt and another thing altogether to get Egypt out of the Israelites. A sense of grim foreboding hangs over poor Moses as he contemplates what could so easily happen once they cross to the other side of that river. See how he puts it in verse 10. When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you, a land with large flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you didn't dig, and vineyards and olive groves you didn't plant, then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Oh yes, I know what will happen, says Moses to himself. Once they're in Canaan, their newfound affluence will go straight to their heads. Before you know it, they will have forgotten Egypt, forgotten Mount Sinai, forgotten God himself. What can I do to stop it? There's only one thing that can prevent such national amnesia and the disastrous consequences that would follow from it. Education. Each new generation of Israelites must be taught the law of God, just as I have taught it to this first generation of the nation. And that's what's behind Deuteronomy 6. Here we find Moses laying down the necessary legislation, like Mr. Baker's gerbil. Israel was to have a national curriculum. Everybody must be taught it, he says. It's compulsory. You, your children, your children's children after them. These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed to me to teach you to observe in the land that you're crossing. And that, of course, is where Moses' national curriculum and Mr. Baker's part come from, isn't it? With those words, commands, decrees, and laws of the Lord. I don't think we know for sure yet what precisely Britain's new national curriculum will consist of. But I would give very long on against it having a word in it about loving God or observing his commandments. Now, judging from what the government's comments have been so far, our national curriculum is going to be about minimum standards in mathematics and the acquisition of computer skills. Mr. Baker is determined that the demands of the workplace in the 21st century shall find an adequate workforce. Education must prepare our children to make a useful contribution to the national progress in a technological age. Well, one can't complain about that, can one? Everybody needs to earn a living. And clearly it is part of education to train us with that end in view. But I do have to say, I find it rather depressing that Mr. Baker can rise no higher than that kind of economic utilitarianism in his thinking about education. Moses knew as well as anybody that Jewish boys and girls would need to learn a trade. And indeed they did learn a trade, as we know. But Moses saw absolutely no need to write a law about that. No, with a surer grasp of the real requirements of the national interest. His national curriculum was not about training in technical skills, but about the transmission of religious values. See how he puts it in verse 4? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. That was the core curriculum for Israel. Now, of course, the whole subject of religious education is fraught with embarrassment for us, isn't it? Some of us, of course, have studied the theories of developmental psychology, and we are very dubious about the ability of children to even conceptualize abstract and metaphysical ideas like God. Others of us are very concerned about breeding intolerance in children. We live in a multicultural society where many different races and religions must coexist. Surely, in a politically divisive world, we ought to keep religion out of the arena of public education. But I think the main reason people resist religious education today is because of a fear of indoctrination. Authority is out of fashion in education today. We're terrified at the thought of brainwashing children or moulding them in some particular way. Now, children must be left to make up their own minds about things. Non-directive education is the thing. Discovery learning. You don't even teach children the two times table anymore. You must let them discover it for themselves. And of course, there's a lot of wisdom in that. It does make education altogether more interesting and more satisfying, so long as these are things people can discover for themselves. But religion can't really be taught that way, can it? The Bible doesn't offer itself to the world as a human discovery, but as a divine revelation. Authorities built into it, as Moses makes clear. These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you. The word of God, by of necessity, comes to us from above. It stands above the student. And that doesn't suit our humanistic vogue at all. Always round, then, religious education has a hard job surviving in our schools today. If it does survive, it does so only as a purely descriptive, comparative study of world faith, or as an exercise examining the sociological function of religion, or something like that. The kind of exhortation we find here in verses 4 and 5, by which Moses gives to an entire nation a challenge to wholehearted commitment to a single monotheistic faith. Love the Lord your God, O Israel, with all your heart and soul and strength. It's almost impossible to imagine such an exhortation being given to the children of any school in Britain in 1988. But it wasn't always so. It's important to realize it wasn't always so. You go back a couple of hundred years in British history, and you will find that all, or most at any rate, of our schools, certainly the finest of them, began life quite explicitly as Christian institutions dedicated to the propagation of the Christian faith. Their roots lay in the Reformation. They had no embarrassment at all about teaching children to believe. Divinity was the queen of the sciences, the subject that held all other sciences and subjects together. But that is no longer the case. And I have to tell you, I believe it is a sad day for Britain that it is no longer the case. For it is the clearest possible indication of the collapse of our Christian heritage. If we no longer feel at ease to teach the children of Britain the Christian faith, the God of the Bible, then we're saying in the clearest possible terms we are a secular society. We no longer see ourselves as a nation under God in the way that once we did. Well, that may be the fact of the matter. That may be something we have to accept. But I have to tell you this morning, I do not believe we can possibly make such a change in our society without paying a price for it. Let me tell you the penalty we pay for ceasing to be a nation under God in the educational sphere. First of all, the price is a complete loss of personal meaning for our children. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. That emphasis on the oneness of God and on the single-mindedness of our commitment to him is much more important than perhaps a cursory reading of that verse might reveal to you. So if you think about it, it is our conviction that behind this plural universe, this universe with all its multitude of phenomena, that behind it there is one God that unifies the field of knowledge for us. We live in a meaningful, ordered world because we can see everything that happens, no matter how diverse, as a manifestation of one creation. The world is a universe, not a multiverse, because God made it, and God is one. What's more, in our quest for personal meaning and significance as human beings, we desperately need a single focus for our lives around which to integrate our experience and our ambitions and our hopes and our values. And there is only one fit object to be that focus of our loyalty. That's God. Love him with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. Like the hub of a wheel, God stands at the center of our human self-understanding. We're made in his image. We cannot make sense of ourselves without him. Strip that hub, then, from the universe and from the human soul, and you're left with an emptiness, a meaninglessness, a spiritual vacuum which is absolutely irreparable. See, our Christian forefathers understood this. Let me read you from the Rules and Precepts of Harvard College, an institution no doubt familiar to some of our American friends, written in 1643. You see, they do have some history over that side of the Atlantic. This is what it says. Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well that the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. They understood it. The world will only make sense, and we will only make sense of ourselves, when we have God at the center, one God around which to integrate our knowledge and our experience. But having thrown out, you see, that God-centeredness to the educational process, what we have today is piecemeal education. An education which is a training in intelligence and memory and skill, but little more. For the modern curriculum is like an invisible clothesline with 8 or 9 subjects hanging in mid-air, but with no commitment to any unifying worldview which will enable all that knowledge to be integrated. You know, we send a child to school, and what does he learn? He goes to his chemistry lesson, and he finds that man is the product of organic reactions. He goes to his biology lesson, and he finds that man is the product of animal evolution. He goes to his geography lesson, and he finds that man is the product of his cultural conditioning. He goes to his history lesson, and he finds that man is the product of economic forces. Finally, he goes to his English lesson, and he finds at least half the authors of the modern world believe that man is a product of nothing at all. A cosmic accident. And when the child at the end of all this input asks the question, well, who am I then? He goes to the RE lesson. And what he discovers there is, well, the Hindus of course think this, and the Buddhists of course think this, and the Confucians think this, and the Christians do think this, and the Jews think that, and the humanists think that, and the Marxists think that. But of course it's up to you to make up your own mind. I tell you, that kind of atomized learning is as unsatisfying as it is unhelpful. It creates spiritual vacuum. Little wonder that Martin Eslin, the literary critic, some years ago wrote, "There can be no doubt that for many intelligent and sensitive human beings, the world of the 20th century has lost its meaning. Things have simply ceased to make sense. Previously held certainties have collapsed. Man sees himself faced with a universe that is frightening and illogical. All assurances of hope, all explanations of ultimate meaning have been smashed as nonsensical illusions, empty chatter, mere whistling in the dark." That's exactly what's happened. And we are programming that sense of meaninglessness into our children. Do we wonder that we have a drug problem? When we are creating this existential vacuum inside people's hearts, they cannot make sense of their world. They cannot make sense of themselves. Such a loss of meaning is implicit. Once you stop making, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." Once you stop making that the core curriculum. Oh, it may be inevitable. But it is also most regrettable. As the first thing I suggest to you, it does. This is the first penalty we pay when we throw God out of the center of our educational system. There is a loss of personal meaning in our children. Secondly, there is a loss of moral certainty among our children. Look at verses 6 and 7 again. "These are the commandments I give you today. They are to be upon your hearts, and impress them on your children." Now, you don't need me to tell you that every day of our lives we make decisions. It's part of us as human beings. We have to make decisions. We have a will. We have freedom. We can choose our way. We're not like animals, just directed by instinct. Sometimes those decisions are random. Nothing determines or constrains them except passing whim. Sometimes they're governed by personal preference. You know, I prefer red to blue when it comes to a tie to wear or a dress to wear. Some decisions we make out of habit, like the newspaper we buy, perhaps, or the number of sugars we put in our coffee. But everybody knows that it is part of our human nature also to feel that some decisions are not constrained by whim or by preference or by habit. They're constrained by duty. They're constrained by a sense of obligation. They're constrained by that strange yet pervasive word, ought. I ought to decide that way, we say to ourselves. And there is no way we are educating our children for life if we don't enable them to make sense of that word ought and to handle it. But how does our secularized education system cope with that? It doesn't cope at all. Bernard Shaw was no friend of the Christian faith, you know, but he wrote, "Children must be taught some sort of religion. Secular education," he said, "is an impossibility. For secular education comes to this, that the only reason for ceasing to do evil and learning to do good is that if you do not, you will be caned." Nowadays, you're not even caned. Now, that may seem harsh and illiberal thing to say, but I think fundamentally Shaw is right. Discovery learning is fine when it comes to things human beings can discover, but the moral law cannot be perceived like that, you see. Morality only has cogency, compelling quality, when I feel that it comes to me from above. That's the nature of the word ought. Morality must have sanctions and authority behind it, like we were saying last week. You can't have the moral law without sanctions and authority. If you try to, the word ought loses all significance. We all know this is the game we were saying last week. When a child receives any kind of instruction, what's its instinctive response? Oh yeah, who says so? And we can't use the word ought unless that question has a valid reply. Oh, I know in infancy it may be enough to say, your dad says so. But we will not get very far unless we can convince our children as they grow older that something stands behind dad's opinion on this matter of rather more weight than dad. If all we can say is, well, you must decide your moral values for yourself, my dear, then what we're really implying, you see, is that ethical values are of really little significance. We don't tolerate choice in issues that really matter for our children. If they're going to put their hands in the fire, we don't say, well, if you really want to, my dear, do so. These things matter. If they're going to swallow bleach, we don't say, have a try. You'll find you don't like it, but do try. Matters of real consequence, we do not permit our children to experiment or discover. We tell them. We use our authority. Because these things matter to their welfare. They are life and death. In the same way, if we have any convictions at all about moral values, we will not communicate them as, well, take it or leave it. Think about it for yourself, my dear, and decide. They will do that anyway. But we are failing them if we communicate those values to them in a way which does not show them how committed we are, how seriously we take them. But this is the problem for the secularist, you see. His ethics are a purely subjective matter. Right is what I feel to be right, what I think is right, what my opinion is about rightness. But of course I could be wrong, I'm probably wrong. And that relativistic kind of moral judgment, you see, has been inculcated today for a whole generation. For we've abandoned those religious roots, which alone can give moral education credibility. Moses hadn't. Moses could say, these are the commands of the Lord your God. And because they were the commands of God, he could tell teachers, impress them on the children. Don't offer them in vague, take it or leave it ways. Impress them on the children. Because the authority of God stands behind them. Once we fail to see morality as resting on the authority of God, we have no basis for that kind of teaching of moral value. And as I say, it shows, it's showing already. Those of you who have children would have probably heard of PSD, Personal and Social Development. It's on the curriculum of most secondary schools now. In at least one Cambridge school, it is translated by the children as pervert sex and drugs. It might be an eye-opener for some of us parents to read the textbooks being written for that subject today. Little wonder our society at large is confused about moral values. Little wonder we're thrown into a spin because we find abortions are being carried out simply because the little fetus is concerned a female rather than male. How does that square with some of us who perform abortions because they're simply not wanted for other reasons than their sexuality? Little wonder we can't even make sense of simple and obvious moral choices like that. When our children are being taught, there is really no way you can tell right from wrong except by how you feel about things yourself. How can we blame them if they try to find out their moral values in the way they do in every other sphere of their learning these days? By discovery. By experiment. A loss of personal meaning, then. A loss of moral certainty. These two things are the inevitable consequence of dislodging God from the centre of the educational enterprise. But there is a third. And Moses is quite clear about it. A loss of national prosperity. He spells it out, doesn't he, in verse 12. Be careful you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Fear the Lord your God, serve him, take your oaths in his name, do not follow other gods, the gods of the people around you. For the Lord your God who is among you is a jealous God, and his anger will burn against you. And he will destroy you from the face of the land. Oh, it's perfectly true, of course, that we are not a covenant nation in the same way Israel was. But as we were saying last week, the Bible makes quite clear that the law which God gave to Israel was not an arbitrary invention for the Jews alone. It was God's law for mankind. It was a reflection of his own character, and we who are his own image find it the right law for us. Whoever we are, Jew or Gentile, there is no change in the moral character of God or his moral demands when we come to the New Testament. When the kingdom of God and the covenant of God is open to all nations, it is the same standards of right and wrong that apply. So when we ask, by what standards is God going to judge the nation of Britain? It is these standards. And the more light we have upon God's law as a culture, then the more accountable we are to him to keep those standards. And you don't have to hear me tell you that there are few cultures in the world that have been more influenced in the past by the Bible than our own. We can take no pride in that. But it is a singular mark of God's grace to us as a culture that so much of our law, so many of our national institutions have been built upon the foundations of biblical Christian understanding. We have a Christian heritage. And for all the Church of England may be in a state of disrepair, if nothing else, it is a testimony to that heritage. If we throw that heritage away, if we neglect God's law then, it is because, just as with Israel, we have deliberately forgotten it. Not because we never knew it. Maybe, as Moses feared, it is our affluence, ironically, the very affluence that came from obedience to God's law, which has been the source of that amnesia as far as spiritual things are concerned. We have come into large cities and prosperous vineyards and forgotten that it was the Lord who brought us out of Egypt. But I'll make no mistake about it, God will judge us for that repudiation of his sovereign claims over us as a people. He is a jealous God. He punishes the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate him. That is his warning. You may not like it, but that is the kind of God we have to deal with. Oh, I've no doubt our government, maybe you yourself, think you can find plenty of explanations for the current economic instability of our Western world and of the escalating statistics of crime and violence in our nation and in many other Western nations. I'm sure you can find sociological explanations, economic explanations, rational, humanistic explanations. But I give it as my opinion to you this morning that whatever second causes you may find, the ultimate cause is this, that we are reaping the harvest of moral and spiritual neglect that we have been sowing for the last 100 or 200 years in our culture. You can't eliminate God from the nation without paying a price. The land of milk and honey is reserved for nations that obey God's law. To nations that flout it, God promises only exile and wilderness. Now, you may be saying to yourself, Roy, this may be right, but if it is, it's extremely depressing. Because really, Roy, what can we do about it? I mean, maybe you're a Christian here, and you share the concern I've been expressing. But you say to yourself, we do live in a pluralistic society. We do live in a secular society. We Christians are a minority now. There is no religious or moral consensus any longer in Britain. So surely the situation is hopeless. What can we possibly do to change things? Well, here I have a tiny word of hope for you. And it brings us to that second element in Moses' gerbil, which is in common with Mr. Baker's. Moses, too, believed strongly in parental responsibility. Look at verses 6 to 9. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Verse 20. In the future, when your son asks you, what is the meaning of the stipulations, decrees, and laws the Lord our God has commanded you? Tell him. Tell him. I think you know that behind the current debate about the Education Act in our country, you can discern a very long-standing question, a tension in educational philosophy generally. It's the tension between the social function of education and the personal function. So on the one hand, there are those who see education as having primarily a social purpose to prepare the child for life in the community. You might call that the state-centered approach. There are others who've tended to embrace a much more individualistic perspective and see the goal of education as the personal development of the child. You can call that the child-centered approach. And for the last couple of 100 years, those two approaches have been at loggerheads with one another, one way or another. If you look back through history, you see, you can see some classic examples of state-centered education, and they don't always make pleasant viewing. In ancient Greece, for instance, everybody believed that education was important because you had to raise the next generation to be good citizens. Education had a political purpose. So in a place like Sparta, for instance, which was a militaristic aristocracy, children were trained from infancy by harsh physical discipline to be warriors. who would obey the orders of their superiors without question. It's not difficult to see that that kind of state-centered education is not very palatable. That's why an awful lot of educationalists in recent years have been more inclined towards the child-centered approach. Most, I think, would agree that Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 18th century was a seminal thinker in this regard. He wrote an important book called Emile in 1762, in which he stressed the importance of allowing children to grow naturally rather than to mould them to fulfil set roles in society. A teacher should see himself as a gardener tending plants, he says, rather than as a potter moulding vessels. It's not difficult to see the attraction of that much more liberal, some would say enlightened, child-centred approach. But it too has its problems, you see. If state-centred education all too easily becomes, as it did in Sparta, an instrument of oppression, indoctrinating children with varying degrees of subtlety into becoming compliant citizens who will do as they are told and preserve the status quo, then it has to be said also that child-centred education can all too easily become a seedbed of revolution and anarchy in society, in which arch-individualists think they have the right to pursue their own fulfillment without regard to any kind of authority or social responsibility. In that connection, it may be no coincidence that Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote that book, Emile, just a few years before the French Revolution. Now, I think our British education system at the moment reflects this long-standing tension. Professional educators in recent years have tended towards the child-centred model. But in the government, there is a growing fear that this is not really producing the kind of British citizen of the future that we want. So they feel they must step in with legislation to make sure it happens. Whatever our educationalists whether our educationists like it or not, they say, the world is a competitive place. There are contracts to be won. The world is a disciplined place. There are rules to be obeyed. The world is a demanding place. There are targets to be achieved. And if you go about eliminating all those experiences in childhood which will prepare them for competition, for discipline, for challenge, then you don't prepare them for the future. And Britain will fall behind other nations in its economic development, they say. Well, you can understand both points of view, can't you? But how on earth do you resolve it? Our whole society, I think, is wrestling, as it has been for a long while, with this tension within education, the demands of the state versus the needs of the child. How do we balance them? How do we protect the child? The problem of education philosophy is, how can we make sure education satisfies society's needs without unfairly manipulating the next generation in the process? And I believe Moses has God's answer to that. And to give him some credit, I think Mr. Baker may have some sympathy with it. The answer is the family. The answer is the family. Moses' education was not state-centered or child-centered. It was family-centered. He placed responsibility for the education of children with their parents. As Nazi and communist well understand, if you want to control the next generation, you must abolish the family. It's comforting to realize that, in fact, when both Nazi and communist sought to do that, they really failed. The family is an amazingly resilient institution. It tends to assert itself, no matter how draconian the state legislation is, to limit its influence. And that must be our comfort. Indeed, that's our opportunity. In a real sense, I hope you understand me, but in a real sense, you know, it doesn't bother me hugely that RE is no longer taught in school. In fact, even in those schools where it is taught, I sometimes think it would be better if it were crossed off the curriculum. It doesn't bother me hugely that personal and social development is taught in such a vague and unsatisfying ways in the curriculum of most schools today. I think that is inevitable in our pluralistic, secularized society. In some ways, I think it would be better, again, if they crossed PSD off the curriculum. But what does worry me is that there are many, many parents who seem to have opted out of educational responsibility for their own children. They think they can transfer their educational responsibility to the state because we have an Education Act, because we have state schools. And in some ways, I fear that Mr. Baker's bill, with its provision of parent governors and that sort of thing, may just encourage still further that thought, that you can transfer the education of your children out of the home into the classroom. I tell you, you can't. Whether you try to educate your children at home or not, they are educated there. The single most important educational influence upon our children is us, their parents. And we can't escape that responsibility, even if we would. It's built in by the very emotional dominance of the parental relationship in the child's experience. They are our apprentices. They model themselves on us. They don't stop learning at 3:30 when they get home from school. They are learning every waking hour of their day. And nowhere do they learn more important lessons, more socially vital lessons than at home. Here they are socialized in the microcosm of the family. They learn to get on with other people. Here they learn to respect authority and discipline. They learn it nowhere else. They learn it in the home. Here in the home, they learn their own value and self-esteem. Here in the home, they develop as individuals and find that individuality valued and appreciated and affirmed. It may not happen in the world, but it happens at home. Parents are uniquely placed, you see, to blend the demands of society and the needs of the child together in a way that fully affirms the dignity of the child and yet brings that child up in a way that is fully ready for society to mix with other people, not to just be a self-centered little individualist. That's what the home is for. In God's purpose. That's why the home is indispensable. That's why the law of God makes no provision for schools. Not because schools are an unbiblical institution that we shouldn't believe in, but because, at the end of the day, schools are dispensable. At the end of the day, schools are unnecessary. Schools are a luxury. But families are not. Families are the God-appointed organ of human education. Moses recognizes that in the law. He stresses it in the law. I don't underestimate the importance of Mr. Baker's gerbil, but neither will I overestimate it. Schools are not as crucial social institutions as some people think they are. As far as the welfare of our community is concerned, family is 1,000 times more crucial than school. And every teacher knows that. Every teacher knows that without the support of parents, without the influence of the home, that child's education is going to be stunted. Every teacher knows that there are certain things you cannot do if the home is not supportive as an environment for the child. Every teacher knows that the diversity they find amongst their children in their classroom reflect the diversity in their home life. Because that's how children are. So what is Moses' advice to us? Us believers who look at our secularized education system and find ourselves frustrated that we cannot do more to make it the kind of education system we really believe in. What does he suggest we do about it? He suggests, no, he commands that we make our home a compensatory educational institution.
where our children learn the moral and spiritual lessons which they cannot possibly learn in a secular school.
See how he puts it in verse 6. These commandments I give you today are to be upon your heart, he says first of all. In other words, parents must have a sincere conviction about God's word themselves. Children are very quick to detect hypocrisy. No point in sending your children along to Sunday school if they don't see those values they are learning in church reflected in the home. No, you must have a sincere conviction about these the word of God yourself, he says. Then, you must be serious and deliberate in your desire to communicate those convictions. Impress them on your children. Or the old version says, teach them diligently to your children. Don't be embarrassed about talking about them. In fact, he says, create a whole atmosphere of informal and continual learning in this area within your home. That's the purpose of talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. That's the purpose of tying them as symbols on your hands or binding them on your foreheads. Create a whole environment saturated with learning. Moses may be implying there, you know, that we should think more carefully about the books we read and have on our bookshelves, the magazines that our children see in the magazine rack. We don't have to literally fulfill this business of tying God's law as symbols on our hands or on our foreheads or writing them on the door frames of our houses as some strict Jews do. But the principle there must be applied. Our children must see visible signs around them of our commitment to God's law. They must find no inconsistency around them. The programs we watch on TV, those precious conversations at bedtime, around the dinner table, on family walks. These are the crucial times. These are the educational experiences that will live in the memory of our children for a lifetime, far more than what they learn at schools. Most important, answering their questions. When your son asks you, "What is the meaning of all this religious lark, Dad?" tell him. Don't be ashamed to give your testimony to your child. We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Before our eyes, the Lord sent miraculous signs and wonders, great and terrible. He brought us out from there to bring us in and give us land that he promised on earth to our forefathers. That's what you're to tell him. Give him your testimony of salvation. That's what this was for the Jew. Don't be ashamed of that testimony. Don't allow it to be heard outside the home but unheard within. The time will come when your child will ask you about right and wrong. He will ask you about death. He will ask you about God. When that moment comes, tell him, says Moses. Speak to him as plainly as you can about what Jesus means to you. Such a home may yet produce believers, even in our secularized, pluralistic society. Oh, I know Christian responses to Mr. Baker's Act are going to be various. Some will seize the opportunity for parental influence in school life and become school governors and so on. I hope they will. Some may opt out in order to provide distinctively Christian schools for their children, opposed to the pluralist education the state can offer. That too may be a valid response for some. But the most vital thing, you know, that any of us can do in this secularized society of which we are now a part is to make sure that our homes are themselves Christian educational environments for our children. Environments where they will obtain the unified worldview and the sense of personal meaning they need to cope as integrated human beings in this world, where most people are completely lost. Environments where they can learn the love of God and neighbor, from which all moral decision-making comes. Environments where they will be socialized and retain yet a sense of personal worth and individuality. Where they will be shaped into citizens without being molded into puppets of the system. Environments, most of all, where they can absorb and build into their own experience the personal relationship with God which they see in their parents. Paul told Timothy, as I'm sure many of you will remember, that he had a great advantage in life. Eunice, his mother, and Lois, his grandmother, had taught him from a child, he said, the Holy Scriptures, which were able to make him wise to salvation. And I tell you, no matter how much money as a nation we spend on our schooling, no matter how much we get involved in PTAs and as school governors ourselves, we can never, never invest in our children's education better than that. Well, let's pray together.